let's go ahead and get started. We will definitely still have a couple other people coming in. The agenda, for those that are new to the call, we have an IRC channel, an IRC chat channel, where we take minutes and share links. That was in the link to the agenda. If you got an email, it's in there. The agenda for today is here. On the agenda today, we've got a number of new participants again, so we're going to do introductions. So if you're new, if this is your first time joining the call, or you haven't introduced yourself to the group before, please do. And then we're going to kind of jump into a couple of topics that we discussed during the Rebooting Web of Trust and the ID 2020 design workshop. So those topics include self-sovereign identity architecture. We're just going to get a real brief kind of overview from the folks that talked about it and try and give some background on what we've been doing in this group when it comes to the identity architecture. Then we've got Dave Crocker is going to kind of give us kind of an overview of just a real quick introduction and his thoughts on the discussion around self-sovereign identity architecture at the ID 2020 Design Workshop. Then we're going to have Drummond give us kind of an overview of the decentralized identifier discussion, and then have Joe Andrew give us kind of a quick update on who he is and the use cases discussion that they had here. Again, this is very preliminary stuff. Nobody's made any decisions on any of this. We're just trying to get these other folks integrated with this group so that we can collaborate a bit more closely. And then the last set of items on the agenda are an update on the work items that we're putting together for the web payments interest group meeting on July 1st at MIT. And so we'll get a quick update of those documents. All right. Are there any other updates or changes to the agenda? Anything else that people would like to discuss today? All right. We have a pretty packed agenda, so we're going to try to move through this quickly. The first up is an introduction to new participants. And I'm just going to go in the order that people joined. If you could just say for the people introducing themselves, just give your name, the organization that you're associated with, and why you're interested in participating in this call. Just a quick 2 to 3 sentences is great. Okay, let's get started. Kiara, I think you were first up.
Sorry. Okay, so my name is Kiara Robles. I'm currently interning at Blockstream. I was a part of the steering committee for the design workshops event, as well as Identity 2020, the UN event there, and I'm hoping to attend the W3C event at MIT.
Fantastic. Welcome to the call.
Thank you.
Adam, you're up next. Adam Lake.
Yeah, I started working with Digital Bazaar last week. And I'm particularly interested in self-sovereign identity and how its goals can be achieved.
Great. Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the call. Dave Crocker.
Hi. I'm a consultant. I've been working around Internet protocols and architectures a long time, mostly around email, which got me into the area of identity, and got drawn into the discussions about self-sovereign identity, went to the stuff in New York, and found myself interested in the architecture that you guys did and am trying to look for some ways to improve it. I think Manu shared some of the output from that. I want to stress how preliminary all that is, and I guess we'll be talking about that later.
Definitely. Thank you, and welcome to the call, Dave. Joe Andrew.
Sure. I'm Joe Andrew. I'm a software guy. I came to this conversation basically because I've been going to the Internet Identity Workshop basically for about 10 years. I'm currently between startups, but I am writing a book about requirement modeling. And this is kind of a it's not a conflation, it's an alignment between, I was really inspired to figure out how to help with requirements modeling after the UN summit, specifically for that SDG 16.9, and if I can contribute here, that seems like it would play along nicely with that effort.
Great. Welcome to the call, Joe. Adam Madlin.
Hi, everybody. My name is Adam Madlin. I am a member, a lead on the Accelerate team for the recently awarded DHS SBIR program for blockchain-based identity systems. I am a longtime identity management person focused around the federal government policy and standards, founding member of the Identity Ecosystem Steering Group and the current board member of that organization. So, and I spend most of my day working on cybersecurity strategy and programs for both federal and state and local governments.
Great, thank you. Welcome to the call, Adam. Drummond, I think you've introduced yourself before, but why don't you go ahead and do it again since you'll be speaking.
Sure, this is Drummond Reed. I'm founder and CEO of Respect Network, and we too are, Respect Network is one of the awardees of the DHS grant on blocks, blockchain identity. We're specifically working on decentralized identifiers, about which I'll report shortly.
Great, thank you. Welcome, Drummond. Jason Law.
Hey, Manu. Jason Law, co-founder and architect at Evernym. We're building a blockchain / distributed ledger that's dedicated to sovereign identity. So you can imagine our interest in the DID discussions and also the sovereign identity architecture. And it was also great to meet with the folks at the design workshop. It was a great, great event.
Great. Welcome to the call, Jason. Bob Bonomo.
Good morning, everyone. I'm an independent consultant focused on blockchain. Obviously, identity is a key pillar to the success of that technology. I'm also working with Adam and Daryl on the Accelerate, the previously mentioned identity blockchain project.
Fantastic. Welcome all, and thank you for those introductions. As the regulars on the call can see, we're getting a large amount of new folks kind of joining the work, which is always great to see. All right, did I miss anyone? Is there anyone new to the call that I skipped over? All right, good. Let's jump into our first topic of the day, which is this discussion around a self-sovereign identity architecture. Let me give a quick background on this. So for the past, I'd say 4 years, starting in the web payments community group, we've been talking about identity and how to exchange verifiable claims. We've called them attestations. They've changed what we call them have changed over the years, but the concepts stay pretty much the same. And these are the same concepts that have been discussed in the identity ecosystem, for lack of a better word, over the past 10 to 15 years. Mainly, through the Internet Identity Workshop and similar fora like that. So this architecture that we're talking about is not necessarily new. It's gone through multiple iterations over the past, 10 to 15 years. More recently, people have started calling it self-sovereign identity or self-sovereign identity architecture. Most recently, we had a meeting in New York City at the ID 2020 event, and then at the Rebooting Web of Trust workshop, the second one held in New York City, and this concept of an architecture surfaced again. So during that event, Dave Crocker and Justin and a few other folks kind of took a look at some of the architecture that we had produced and kind of provided their thoughts. So the architecture is important because this is what we're going to be showing the W3C membership in the next 2 months, let's say. So in 2 months, this will be in front of 400 voting members at the W3C. So we're trying to get it in good shape. That in no way means that the architecture is done. It just means that we've taken kind of a first cut at it. We've tried to say this is what we think the architecture is going to be. So that's the reason we're discussing this today, is because we need to, you know, quickly come to a consensus around what the architecture we want to present to the W3C membership is. So with that said, as kind of a background, Dave Crocker, would you mind kind of giving us an introduction of, you know, on you and your thoughts and you know, whatever you'd like to talk about with respect to the architecture?
Thank you, sir. So good morning. The first thing I want to stress is my own view of architecture diagrams is that they need to be as simple as possible, show functional elements and the relationships between them in a way that should not take a reader much effort to understand. The more intuitive these things are, the more useful they tend to be. The balance against that is they need to be complete enough to say something that is in fact useful. On the average, the architecture documents I see are horrendously complicated and often not very enlightening. So reading the draft that Manu circulated was just a delight. The diagram you guys have is reasonably, it's very simple and reasonably straightforward. Now the downside of that is that it makes it easy to ask questions that are basic and may or may not be answerable. And so what we did during the New York discussion was to look at things that might enhance it, and I do want to stress enhance rather than replace. We went through an exploration of that over a number of hours. I believe Manu circulated some diagrams that were produced out of that. Those just represent the snapshot of that moment. And we have a task of going and producing something real soon now that we might circulate back to you that we think is a more stable version. An example of things that might be worth looking at further is this morning I was looking at your diagram, and for that matter the revision, and realized that nowhere in that is there an indication of the identity itself. So there's all these actors on identities, but there's no box for the identity. Maybe there shouldn't be, but that's something to think about. And going through these exercises of thinking about what are the major components and how complete does this need to be is sort of part of the challenge of that. The other piece I'll add, and you may notice I'm not actually trying to go into detail about what we produced because I don't think we're ready to talk about that yet, unless you guys have questions. But the other thing that I tend to find useful is having diagrams that work at different levels. And so, for example, there reasonably could be a diagram for what I'll call the public behaviors, as distinct from one or more diagrams that might be about private behaviors. Now my usual frame of reference is email, and there's the user agent and the mail transfer agent, and that was the original architecture that we came up with in 1980. If you look at RFC 5598, which is an attempt to do the fairly detailed architecture of email today, UA and MTA are still there, but my goodness, there's a lot more. And the fact that the original is still valid, I think, is useful. And then the challenge is for any equivalent architecture to take a simple base and then expand on it. And so one example is that the repository, from what I understood from the document, the repository is actually internal to the holder. And so while it's an important component, might not need to be shown in the very basic global architecture. I'm done.
Great. Thank you, Dave. And for those of you that don't know, Dave is one of the original people that created or standardized the email system that we use today. So, you know, if you use email today, you have Dave to thank for that. And Dave was very involved in the architectural vision for how email would be put together and would work on the general internet. So if you want to put yourself on the queue to ask questions or make comments, you can do that in IRC by typing Q and the plus sign. If you don't have access to a computer, you can just say, hey, I'd like to say something. Christopher Allen, you're on the queue. Go ahead.
Thank you. So, Dave, one of the things I was really intrigued by and feel some alignment with, but I'd like to understand the team's thoughts at the moment, was you pulled in the original one that Manu shared, we had sort of DID in the center that was sort of talking to everything in a way. And in the newer one, you moved it over to call them call that being a number of different oracles. Could you speak a little bit about, you know, where that came from and why and what were the thoughts? And
sure, and I fully expect this to be a controversial topic of discussion. One side point, it wasn't in your question, but it was a point I think worth making because it's a larger point. The diagram had a distributed hash table, you referred to it as DID, I don't remember whether it had that label, but certainly during the meeting there were many references to DID. And similarly, the other box that was there that we merged into Oracle was called Ledger. And one of the challenges in doing architectures like these is to distinguish between abstractions versus implementations. And Ledger, I think, has come to take on a particular technical approach. And the issue isn't whether it's the right or a good or the best approach. It's that it's an implementation approach rather than an abstract function. Similarly, for the DID, there's an essential function there, and then there's how it might be implemented. Now, moving to your question, I think Justin was actually the one who saw this, and it was, I thought, a good bit of insight, and that is that the other actors in this system need to make queries for information. And there's different types of queries. One, of course, is about the identity itself. Another might be about some history of claims involving. Another might be for other dynamic data. The ledger reference on the average refers to something that is a growing journal, but it's offering data that is static with respect to when it was created. And one might want to have queries to sensors or other parts of the internet that are more dynamic. And so the idea was to merge these various kinds of queries that one might make with respect to an identity into a single architectural abstraction. And then under that is to list the different kinds of query services one might have. And I think those are listed in the box that came out of New York.
Yeah, and so I think the box that came out of New York, you know, says Oracle at the top. I just dropped the link into IRC. It has Oracle at the top, and I think these things include things like ledgers, generators, registries, file stores, things of that nature. Anyone else have questions? Or Christopher, you're back on the queue. Go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to say I'm intrigued by this change because it has some implications with things like smart signatures and, you know, some other kind of architectures that, you know, can really make use of a variety of oracles. And if you think of them all kind of in different ways, you know, in what we mean cryptographically by oracles, it's an interesting new way to sort of think about it, and that's what my appeal was.
Great, thanks. Is there anyone else that has questions about the architecture diagram or the discussion or you know, how we integrate some of this work with the work that we're doing in this group? All right. Well, I think the good news, Dave, is that there's no screaming to stop going down this path. So I think the plan is over the next couple of weeks to refine the thinking around, you know, whatever path, to refine the thinking around the diagrams and, you know, have a very good story for why every single box exists and exactly what the box does and things of that nature. With the goal of, you know, finalizing hopefully in the third week of June, which is only, you know, we've only got 3 weeks for that, and then putting it, you know, third week of June is when the web payments interest group would start reviewing it, and then we would figure out whether or not we want to take this architecture to a W3C vote during the web payments IG meeting on July 1st. Dave, does that sound like a realistic timeline to you, or is that crazy?
So this is Dave, assuming you're asking me. Yes, I think so. I think I'm getting a little more time to be able to focus on it over the next week or two. And let me encourage anyone who might have questions or comments they want to do offline, please do feel free to contact me. I'm mostly friendly.
Here's help.
All right. okay, if there's nothing else in that item, we're going to quickly move on to our next topic. As soon as I can find the tab that contains our agenda, which I think I destroyed by going to another link. Next topic up is decentralized identifiers. In this group, we have known for a very long time that the decentralized identifier problem is a very, very hard right. problem to solve, but it's one that we need to solve if we want self-sovereign, what we've been calling user-centric identities mm-hmm. in this case, or user-centric credentials. But this new term, this other term, self-sovereign identity and self-sovereign credentials has also kind of shown itself. So the key thing between all of these different identity groups is this understanding that we need to be able to have this identifier that a person themselves, that cannot be taken away from them through, you know, force or coercion or other mechanisms, or it's very hard for that to happen. So in this group, we've, you know, created this concept of a what we've been calling a web DHT, which isn't really a DHT. It's a decentralized hash table with history. So it's some combination of DHT and ledger. But as Dave said, you know, that's kind of getting into the implementation details. A higher level requirement is that we have an identifier that someone can instantiate and own, and that is very difficult to take it away from that person, difficult if not impossible to take it away from that person. This is kind of the decentralized identifier discussion. We've talked about various systems that could give us decentralized identifiers. Blockchain has come up many times. Journal DHTs have come up a number of times. But rather than get into those kind of implementation details, I think it might be good to, you know, wind back and kind of look at some of the requirements for decentralized identifiers. So Drummond and Les and Christopher at the ID 2020 event took a very good deep look at this stuff, both on requirements and implementation. And my hope is that Drummond can kind of give us a a rundown of that discussion at the ID 2020 event and can kind of give us an idea of how we may integrate some of that work with the verifiable claims work moving forward. So, Drummond, over to you.
Thanks, Manu. It was a very intense discussion over the 2 days. We had almost continuous sessions on DID architecture throughout the 2 days over the weekend. And so what I'll read you here quickly is notes that I've been putting together from that. Where we did get to consensus was on the goals of DID decentralized identifier architecture as Manu just explained it. And we came down to two key goals that for the DID itself, the identifiers, we said the goal was to define the structure of an identifier that can serve as a universally unique system-independent discoverable key for a value. So it's the key, and the value part we call the DID object. And there we said the goal was to define the structure of a value for a DID that can meet four requirements. And those requirements fall into two groups. The first group is to provide cryptographic proof of A, ownership of the DID, and B, permission to update the DID object. And it was felt it was quite important to separate proof of ownership from proof of access control permission to update the DID object so that it can change over time. And the second two requirements were for the DID to, object to be able to provide pointers to A, other sources of claims, and B, other peer DIDs. Meaning it became very clear that for purposes of privacy protection, a person or a principal, because DIDs may not just represent people, they may also be organizations or things, that the principal may need to have multiple or many DIDs to keep their personas or relationships separate. And this led to the thought towards the end of the workshop of realizing that from the standpoint of claims-based identity, the combination of a DID and DID object, for which we didn't come up with a good combination together, but we've since started calling it DID tuple, DID tuple is the genesis claim for an identity. It is the starting point from the standpoint of self-sovereign identity. It represents the starting point. we then, I'm going to share a thought that really sort of surfaced and has received more, a little more discussion since then. And it was that DIDs, large part of our discussion was around what we would call a public DID, meaning a discoverable DID, so you can refer to an oracle, be it Web DHT or a ledger or a store of some kind, to discover and look up and verify a DID. That is a public use of a DID, which would correspond to what Kim Cameron Laws of Identity called an omnidirectional identifier. And while there's great benefit to those, from a privacy perspective, there are also real limitations. It is obviously highly correlatable as an omnidirectional identifier. So we recognize that it's equally valid to have cases for private DIDs that are shared only between two parties or a limited number of parties explicitly to control correlation of whatever might be correlated, any set of claims. And that corresponds to what Kim Cameron in the Laws of Identity called a unidirectional identifier. We think it's important that DID architecture encompass both. And the final summary I'll give you of what was hours of discussion is around DID discovery architecture, meaning the different ways in which you could look up or find a DID, look it up, get the associated DID object, and then process that object to either provide the proof or follow the pointers. And there were four overall options that received a great deal of discussion. The first one was just basically using ledgers or oracles, as they were talked about, as peers, and just basically register a DID in any ledger that you want, sort of to each his own, which provides lots of independence but doesn't provide any known starting point for discovery. If you're using, you know, Bitcoin Ledger or Ethereum or Sovereign or these other ledgers or WebDHT. The second major bucket was what we call addressable ledgers, and that's where the ledgers, one approach is to treat them as part of the URI space, so they have prefixes. Another thing was discussing putting together a ledger of ledgers. But in any case, it makes them, it would make the DID itself addressable on a ledger or a store of some kind, uniquely so. But it also locks it into a particular ledger, so it's got a question of portability. The third option was looking at meta-consensus protocols, meaning how to conceive, if you wanted DID uniqueness across a set of ledgers, how the ledgers themselves could do that, but that would have to be implemented by each of the ledgers. And then the last option was what we started calling the index ledger, or which I think corresponds most closely to what in the diagram was the DID registry, which is the idea that there is, again, by consensus, of course, a single DID registry that to index DIDs where the actual DID object may be stored in another location on some of the ledger, but there is a master index that can be referenced by client software. That's a very high-level overview of all we discussed. As you can tell, there's a lot more work to be done here. One of the steps Respect Network is taking as part of our DHS work is we are interviewing, doing in-depth interviews with individuals that are very interested in this area, want to contribute to the development of DID architecture. And anyone on this call that would like to participate in those interviews is an open invitation to just contact me to do that.
Great. Thank you, Drummond. Christopher, you're on the queue.
Yeah, so a couple of key points, some of which is because it was sort of decided before the last meeting. One of the things that we're very much punting on that caused problems in the past is naming. So the DID approach to things, and maybe this should be reflected in the self-sovereign architecture or whatever, names are credentials, not identifiers. You know, they may have, you know, allowed you to bootstrap into discovery and some other different types of things of that nature, but they are very explicit. Just because we now, with blockchain technologies, have the ability to achieve Zuko's triangle doesn't necessarily mean we should, because once names are in the story, things get complex, and you know, people want the right to revoke names that are trademarked or harmful or are whatever. So we're explicitly separating that out. And that may not be something that the verified credentials group has really thought as much about, that the verified claims could be, you know, names. Second thing was just a little bit of detail on the sort of meta DID discussion. One of the key things that we wanted to have was the ability to be able to move this root identifier from one chain to another, that self-sovereign users would be able to have the choice not only of what chain do they establish root their personal
data in, but they also have the ability to move it. And we think we have some good answers there by, in effect, of, you know, having every chain has its own DID in a sense. And we think we may know how some methods by which, you know, you can basically leave one chain, carry your proofs to another chain. Both of those things are hard, but we believe that we've done enough that we can at least say that it's likely to be possible with the architecture we have. I don't want to get stuck on proving that we can move from chain to chain before we, you know, start implementing 1.0 of DID. So I just want to be clear, it's our intent to have a design that allows for that kind of portability, you know, but the actual, you know, cryptographically doing it correctly, you know, maybe a 2.0 or a 1.1 type of thing. That's it.
Great. Thank you, Christopher. If anybody else, of course, wants to ask questions or, you know, has something to say, please put yourself on the queue. I do have one thing, and that's, so this DID stuff is a long-term need for the verifiable claims work, right? It's the fundamental identifier that we can tie, that we would like to tie stuff to. Today, in the current verifiable claims architecture that we have, we're just using URLs. So we're basically telling people that, you know, if you want to use this stuff today, then you're going to have to bind the verifiable claims to a URL, and as a result, whoever owns that domain is the one that really kind of has control over whether those claims are valid or not, meaning they can take the domain down, they can do a variety of nasty things with the domain. So we would like the DID stuff to replace that eventually. There is a system up already called Authorization.io that simulates this DID system, meaning that we do issue DIDs. We have DID objects. All these concepts are working in the current set of demos that we have. The issue, of course, being that they're just backed by a regular database. These things need to be on a decentralized database. They need to be self-sovereign. So there are a number of requirements that we haven't quite achieved with the current demos and implementations. So, you know, we don't need this stuff for the W3C work. We don't need it to be ready and us have a clear design of this stuff by the time the W3C membership votes on it. But we do need to kind of know what the plan going ahead is and how we're going to be working together on this and things of that nature. So, Drummond, you know, not to put you on the spot, you're Christopher on the spot, but, you know, what do you guys feel are the next steps with DID architecture and the system? Do you have any kind of time frame in mind? Just a general question to both of you guys.
Sure. This is Drummond. I'll answer first. One of the time frames is that Respect Network's contract with DHS is a 6-month period, and our job under that is to perform as many interviews as we can. We're trying to do 20 or 30 of them by the end of this month of June. It's still May, so by the end of June, and then produce a sample architecture and a prototype. Now it could be one of many, but it's to produce at least one. So we're operating under that time frame, and we anticipate that a spec should or would come out. And, you know, not quite clear. There was a lot of input about the potential structure of that. But that's a rough trend. I'd certainly like to get through the heart of the work this summer and have something that's implementable and testable in the fall.
Fantastic. Any additional thoughts on that, Christopher, or Les?
Yeah, so there is a a company, one name that is also, you know, backing a nonprofit foundation called Blockstack that has implemented, you know, various aspects of this in their own architecture. But of course, it's you know, it's their own architecture for this, and you know, increasingly, you know, we're working with them to try to, you know, bring some alignment and with things. So in effect, there is a you know, they offer a DHT, they offer some other different types of work that you know, with some efforts this summer may also be able to come in line, come in alignment with the overall DID and self-sovereign architecture. So the thing is, they've got a production system, they've got a lot of users, but you know, at this point, they unless Ryan is on this call, I can't speak on specifically, but it's like, you know, they're moving forward to be an implementation of this on a single blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain. The other thing I wanted to say is there is, in order to do DIDs properly, you have to have a proof of existence. So if anything moves forward in the proof of existence stuff that was also worked on at the design shop, then that'll make it easier for, you know, the DID standards to move forward. And I've talked with Ryan about the idea of moving over to linked data signatures with a proof of publication, and also with the IPFS community around the same thing. And there's at least an interest to have a standard way of doing that, and you know, using linked data signatures as one of the ways of doing that, not necessarily exclusive, but one.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, Christopher. Unless there are any other comments or questions, we're going to move on to the use case review just really quickly. Anything else on decentralized identifier architecture or timeline? Okay, one of the other things that happened at the ID 2020 event is that a group broke out to talk about use cases around self-sovereign identity and verifiable claims and things of that nature. They took a look at the use case document that Shane has been prepping for the W3C, upcoming W3C potential vote. So they took a look at those use cases and had some thoughts on it. But we're not going to go through that review today. We just wanted to kind of introduce everyone to Joe Andrew, who led the work on the use case review, and then just have him give us kind of his ideas on potentially integrating their review with the work that we're doing here. So go ahead, Joe, if you're on the call.
Sure. Thanks, Manu. So I just posted a link to the, you know, literally these are the notes captured off the whiteboard and written up. I'm doing a more formal write-up, but let me just give you a quick walkthrough, because part of what I want to do is make sure that the write-up I'm doing is aligned with the work that Shane's doing and the rest of the, so that you guys can use what we're doing. I don't want to do a lot of busy work that doesn't make sense to you guys. So basically, we had about an hour to review this document that we hadn't read and try and make some sense of it. And so we ended up feeling that, you know, just sharing back how easy and hard that was for this group of technologists to understand identity on some level, to get through that document, and that's sort of what these notes are. Our first impressions were mainly that we wish the human value was more of a driving thread, that popped out more clearly. You know, so it flowed as illustrations of technical functionality, as opposed to here are the human problems that we're solving, and here's how the system addresses that. So that's the short version. You know, you can look at these quick notes. You know, some of the things that we wanted were, sorry?
Can you pick one and as an example?
So one of the things we wanted were human easily recallable titles for either the use cases or the scenarios, and I appreciate that there's some confusion even in my own head about the right way to distinguish between those, because you have multiple scenarios for each of the use cases you have listed. So things like, pull up the list. So the lazy doctor, and so this is towards the bottom, so this is Barney in use case 4.3.1. So as we went through the use cases, we tried to come up with, okay, what's a short name that encapsulates the human value there? And for the lazy doctor, that actually attracted a comment from the rest of the workshop when we echoed this back. They said, well, what's the lazy doctor and what's a bad university? And so that made it very easy for us to focus on, oh, well, the lazy doctor, he just hasn't maintained his credentials, whereas the bad university has had their accreditation pulled. And so having those sorts of names made it easier for us to engage the group about it. So that was an answer to your question. That was the kind of thing that we walked through. And so what I want to do is I'm writing this up with a little bit more prose so it stands on its own and so you can sort of get the gist of where our conversation went. And then I'd like to give some examples of what I call requirements modeling. This is what I'm writing my book on and what I hope to do for this the Sustainable Development Goal 16.9 with the UN, which is basically not requirements engineering, it's modeling, because all models are wrong, some models are useful. And so I have some tools and techniques that I think could help address some of these issues, make the use cases potentially easier to absorb. I think a good use case should let you quickly grasp both that unique human value proposition and the essential interactions that fulfill that proposition. And so, one of the notes in the from the conversation was there was a lot here to digest. Now, we were trying to get through it in, an hour. So we were sort of force-fed this. And so, there was a tension between the fact that, when you're going through a standards process and you need a rigorous specification, okay, there is a lot of, you need to have the detail. So we sort of weren't even allowed to have the patience for that, if you will, during our process. But I think it still drives in the same way that Dave pointed to about an architectural diagram being, the simpler it is, the more intuitive it is to work with. I think the same is true with use cases. So I'd like to, finish our write-up and give some examples of how I would take a requirements modeling approach to that and echo that back to the group, and if it's useful, then that would be great.
Awesome. Thank you, Joe. I'm not certainly not speaking for anyone else on the call, but I think it would be fantastic to see that, and it would be very useful. I don't think anyone's taken that strategy when reading through the use cases yet. And I think, that your group was kind of forced to do this in an hour is really good. It's a good way to read the document because the W3C membership, the people that are going to be voting on it, will look at the document for maybe 5 to 10 minutes and then move on. So, it's this document, the use cases document, ends up driving a lot of the requirements and things that we need if a working group were to start up, right? So the use cases, people make two passes over the use cases at W3C typically. One of them is a quick pass, 5 minutes, to see if, it's in line with what they think and they want to vote in favor of starting technical work on it. So that's the first kind of set of people. The second set of people are the people that are doing the technical work in the working group, and they're going to look through the use cases with a fine-tooth comb, but usually only when they want to prove that the architecture that we're building needs a certain feature or not, right? They'll point to use case and say, look, we can't get this use case done if we don't have feature X. So you looking through that and giving us your analysis on it is going to be super, super helpful. And thank you in advance for taking the time to do that. Any other questions on use cases? Before we move on, we have one more item on the agenda. 5 minutes.
This is Shane. I just had one comment about it for Joe. You said that you had some trouble getting your mind around the difference between scenarios and use cases, and I take full responsibility for that because this is my structure. But frankly, it's not structured as use cases and scenarios. It's really structured as requirements and then use cases that support those requirements. So the scenarios are effectively use cases. If that helps.
Right. Sure. It's interesting. It's sort of less that I'm confused about the distinction and more that use cases are overloaded to mean a lot of different things. And so, you know, the scenarios, the way you have them definitely align with scenarios as I've seen them before. But sometimes you have a use case, it's more in the problem domain. Sometimes you have a use case, it's more in the solution domain. And so I appreciate the clarification you just made that, yes, it's about specifications and then following from that. So that does help.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Awesome. Great. All right. Next topic up is just a quick update on the work items. I don't think a lot of stuff has happened just because everyone's kind of busy. The charter hasn't been updated. We just got an update on kind of the use cases. FAC has not been updated. Data model specification hasn't been updated. Survey results. We're waiting to get feedback from the ID 2020 folks. So I'm going to send out another request to fill out a survey and just open it up for a week because I think we'll be able to get maybe 20 new companies providing input on the surveys. The other thing that's happened is some of you heard Adam Lake's introduction earlier in the call. I think we're hoping that Adam is going to be working on either the AC rep summary or helping with the architecture summary over the next couple of weeks. Adam, again, sorry to put you on the spot, but do you want to give us kind of your thoughts on the AC rep summary or what you're trying to work on there? Or the architecture summary?
Yeah, no problem. Excuse me. Yeah, I definitely am getting up to speed over the last week and I'm feeling pretty comfortable with moving forward on the architecture summary as well as the W3C advisory committee summary. So I think that we'll be on track with that for the third week in June.
Okay, great. Fantastic. And this is just to remind everyone, this is the document, the AC rep summary. AC stands for advisory committee. And so the W3C advisory committee is composed of, I think, 419 people now, and they need a brief one-page thing telling them why they should vote for this or why they should not care. Or rather, we want a one-pager that says why they should vote for this stuff to progress at W3C. And implementer summary we haven't done yet. I think that's an update on the work items. Is there anything else that we should be aware of before next week's call? Anything else really important going on this week that we should keep our eye on?
Well, I definitely think people should keep an eye. If you're sort of coming here, as some people are, with some blockchain-oriented things, there is the blockchain workshop the 2 days prior to the workshop that we're having. You can, you know, do both in one trip, basically. So, and that's the blockchain workshop at MIT W3C community.
Right. That's at the end of June, right?
Yes. It's the 2 days before our workshop.
Yep. Okay. Anything else? David Azell, you're on the queue. Go ahead.
Hey, my name. I was just going to say
as you know, I'm probably going to get a chance to talk to you later this week. But as far as pushing things to the AC, let's work on trying to get a story in front of IG as soon as possible. If it looks like that's where we're going.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, that was my hope, is that is what we would be talking about later this week.
Okay. I feel like I haven't talked to you in about a month.
It's been a while. All right. Well, that's time for the call today. Thank you, everyone, again, for a packed call, a great call. We'll meet again next week, where we are going to be heads down on getting these items together, a voting package together for W3C membership. Okay. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks, Manu.